Welcome to the Agile Wire, brought to you by Wisconsin Agility. We want you to get agile and stay agile. Now here are your hosts, Jeff Bubbles and Chad Beyer.
And we're recording. All right, kick us off, Jeff.
All right, we have Martin Dullman back on the podcast with us. Martin, you just finished your book, Sprint Goals, 3 years in the making. It's got to feel good. So just tell our users, why did you write this book on Sprint Goals? I mean, Sprint Goals have been around in the Scrum Guide for quite a while, but why write the book?
Why write the book? So basically, there wasn't a book. That was what made it most appealing to me. Like, nobody had written a book, and you know, Scrum and Agile is a pretty crowded space. So I was just thinking, am I going to write another book about Scrum and Agile, or I'm going to try to write something interesting about Sprint Goals? And that was my main motive. But of course, right, the secondary motivation was I had this strong feeling that I could write something like that that was different, that people would like to read. This was my hope, of course. Time will tell.
Yeah, I think it is different. I think you poke at maybe some of the status quo things out there and give different viewpoints that maybe some people aren't used to. Like, one of the things was carryover work. You say it's okay. So tell us more about that. Like, why is it okay to have carryover work?
Yeah, because the way I see it, right, like, you have a sprint goal and you're working on that during the sprint. So you're trying to achieve something. And if you're on the final day of the sprint and you've met the sprint goal, or like, you can pick something up. It's okay to carry, like, I don't, like, as long as you meet the sprint goal, you've done a great job. And I don't like this artificial boundary that's like, no, you cannot pick up something on the final day, or something you started working on, it's undone. Like, it just seems very artificial to me. And yeah, so I don't believe we should care about that. As long as every sprint we meet our goal and there's a little bit that falls off, we'll pick it up next sprint. Nobody's going to die. Like, yeah.
And it can be a really good thing for teams too, right? Have consistent flow. Like, if it's these big peaks and valleys, like, yeah, depending on how your team works, like, there might be a time in the sprint where it's like, how do I contribute in the best way possible? Or, how do I help right now when we're getting to the end of the sprint and they've got the testing and they're finishing up the automated testing over here? And maybe, like, I don't have anything else. Do I not start something? What do I do? And so I think, yeah, start something else, like, get going on it. And then you can provide the value next sprint, you know? So I think that's a really good way to look at it. What are some of the things that you would, you know, people struggle with sprint goals. They really do. Like, they struggle with how to narrow it down, and what if my team has disparate items, and how do we not make it select star from the sprint backlog? Like, do all the things, right? So, like, what are some practical things that people can do to make their sprint goals better?
Maybe it's good to start with some valid reasons. Like, there are some valid reasons that I've discovered. Like, it's very difficult to set a sprint goal, but those are usually pretty unusual in my experience. So one of them is you're working at a digital agency, 10 projects, one team. You have to serve those 10 customers. You have to do those 10 projects simultaneously. Yeah, then it's pretty hard, right? You cannot say we're going to do one of them, no. So that's one situation. Another situation is a product late in the lifecycle, right? So those are all valid. Like, if you're late in the product lifecycle, you have all these small improvements, it's difficult to set a goal. But very often, my opinion is, if you cannot set a common goal, that's a symptom of other dysfunctions. There is no clear vision or no clear strategy. Like, it, or you're a component team, right? So you're like 10 other teams need you. So why is it not possible? That's the main question. And then once you can answer that question, then you can think about solutions. And there are many different reasons, in my experience.
So I just completed the book as well, Martin, yesterday. And I guess I'm shifting gears here a little bit. So
yes, it's good. It's good.
I like it when I like it when I read a book and it rattles me a little bit in a good way. And there's one word that has been rattling around in my brain the last 24 hours.
Ooh.
That I think is so impactful from this book. And of course, this word gets combined with another word to make a phrase, but the word humble.
Yeah.
You really had me reflecting, right? Going back to my days living through waterfall organizations, trying to, have grassroots movements to make change in those organizations. my project management days when I knew this doesn't feel right. We've got to be, there's got to be a better way to deliver things. The word humble combined with the word planning, humble planning or humble plans, I think is, I believe is the most impactful piece of this book, which is interesting because it's, I mean, it has a lot to do with sprint goals, but I think it goes so beyond that, right? Like, I think that the book title is great. And actually, I had to look back on it. I noticed the subtitle does have the word humble in it, correct? Am I remembering this correctly? Yeah.
Yeah, you're remembering this correctly.
So does it impact you the way it impacted me as a reader, like as you writing it?
Sorry.
I love it.
So I just want to hug you, right? Because that's exactly how I felt as a writer. I like, but the funny thing is, I came up with this word very late in the end of the book. Like it was not something I came up initially because I was reading the book and you've read the book, so I tried to introduce all these ways to make it easier to understand, like the fog of beforehand, like we cannot know everything before starting, the fog of speculation. But this planning thing was nagging me because I was thinking, actually, if I look at my book, it's all about planning. Like we cannot plan everything up front. Overconfident planning drags you down. But what is the right way? And I was just thinking of a label because a label makes everything easier. And I was just thinking, humble planning, like rooted in reality. It's not about planning less, right? It's about like starting with simple plans that acknowledge there's a lot you don't know. There's going to be surprises. And then as you do the work, you learn and discover, you make your plans less humble. So you can plan more, but it's rooted in reality. So yeah, sorry, I'm getting excited because that's exactly what I felt as well.
No, I mean, that's so great. I mean, I was so excited. We actually had a talk this week at a local organization, and I started stealing your words immediately and started using the contrast between overconfident planning and humble planning. And this was with a group of project managers in the audience. And it... Again, I think they're the right words. I think had I had that phrase, but that particular phrase, even a year ago, 5 years ago, I would have approached conversations differently, I think, in organizations where there's just way too much overconfident planning, right? And it's crazy because if you ask somebody to, you know, you get how many weekends in a year? 52 weeks in a year. So every weekend... Right, we think these are all the things I want to get done on my house and my apartment, you know, in life, like my car, the things you want to do, your task list for every weekend. Can you imagine how crazy it would be, like if you planned your entire all 52 weeks at the beginning of the year and thought that that was actually going to come true? We would all shake our heads and be like, "No, that's silly. Like we know we're never gonna, we can't do that." But yet, we do that all the time professionally. Overconfidently inside the organizations we work for. And again, I just love the phrase humble planning. We need to be more humble. I think I used to use the phrase like live in reality or be more practical, but it doesn't hit the same, I don't think, as humble, because I think humble, it makes you check your ego. It makes you think about, is this me being overconfident instead of just following the status quo of like, this is what we do when we plan. So I don't know. I love it. I highly recommend the book just to take away every phrase that has the word humble in it.
Just read the subtitle and then you're good.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it won't stick, right? It's more of a mindset, you know, that humble planning. And so I mean, highly recommend reading the book too. I was telling Martin before we started recording, like started reading it, and you know, we do a lot of agile stuff, read a lot of agile books. And so a book on sprint planning, maybe I wouldn't normally just read that, but because we were talking with Martin, I'm like, I'm definitely reading that. And I was blown away at how much good stuff. There's like gold nuggets all over the place inside of this book. Just how to move from that feature factory into just like being more outcome based and more like what we would call strategic agility. There's just so much good stuff inside of that, your whole book about that. And I guess that's one of my hopes for the world, is that all the agile teams out there in the world can move away from feature factory and move into more of strategic agility and get to feel the joy that comes from, you know, delivering great results for your product. And this book has a lot of good tips in there. One of the things that, you know, I really liked though with the humble planning and something to look for is that small backlog, right? If you have a small roadmap or in small product backlog with less items on it, that is an indicator that you're probably already doing humble planning. And so if you have a really long-term, very detailed one, that's a pretty good sign that you're taking more of the feature factory route and you're being a little too bold on like what you think is going to happen in the future, because you're going a little too far out there, right? And so you're going to have a lot of rework. You're probably going to have to reset expectations. It's probably going to be a little painful as you have to refigure things out as you move through, you know, this complex world we call product development.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I call it the Christmas wish list backlog, I think, in the book.
Yes, that's a great analogy. Yeah, just because you want it to happen doesn't mean it's, you know, going to happen, right? So
no.
So just maybe the gaps is another one to dive into. I found that really interesting. The three gaps you talk about.
Yeah.
The knowledge gap, alignment gap, and effective gap. Maybe you can talk a little bit about what those three are and how they deal with sprinkles.
Yeah. So Stephen Bungay wrote a really lovely book, The Art of Action, and this model is from his book. And he actually studied military history, and von Clausewitz coined the concept of friction. And friction is kind of like during war, like there are all these unexpected things that can happen. There's going to be a little bit of fog, right? So you don't see the enemy coming. It's going to be a little bit more muddy. So the horses arrive late. So all these little factors that you couldn't anticipate, but it can have a huge impact. So Stephen Bungay studied like all these military history, and he came up with a model, three gaps model, knowledge gap, right? When we don't know as much as we would like to know. Effects gap means that when we our actions, they people don't do what we expect them to do, and the results effects gap, like our actions, they don't lead to the desired results. So basically what it boils down to is the more friction you have, the more surprises, the more these gaps become. And that means you need to change your plans. you need to change your plans and actions to achieve the desired results. And that's in essence what it's about.
And I love the military references that you kind of go back and forth to. It really makes you think, you know, it's not like it's war that we're going through in product development, but it's complex like war is, right? There's things that are ever changing. And that commander's intent that you talk about too, you know, like I think we've said stuff like that, but I like the way that you kind of talk about it, you know, like that's the goal, the sprint goal, so that we have a rallying point. This is what we're trying to get to. And how we get there, the team's going to have to figure that out as we, you know, march through, you know, building the product. And so I think it's a really great thing. Like a shared goal is a great way to align people, and not something that's more like get this output done, something that's an output done, not outcome. Trying to focus it more towards an outcome really does help people, you know, try to brainstorm, be problem solvers, and take a more engaged look at like how do we solve this problem. So yeah, I like the way you talked about that as well.
You know, overall, I think you did a great job of balancing that spectrum between practical and purist, I guess, on the other end of the spectrum. You acknowledge that in various passages. And I just like how you called out some of the common things, right? And you didn't just point at them as like, this is right or wrong, but you took a lot of nuance in the way you discussed this. You know, I think too often, sometimes on social media, we see people in the Agile community bickering, and there are these one little, you know, sentences fired across the internet, and then all the context gets lost. And it's just, after a while, people are like, why is everyone arguing? But I like that you had time in this book to talk through some of them. So a few examples that jump out at me, again, very common things are like how teams use spikes. I love that you mention, there's some phrase in here, messy burn down charts are healthy, right? Like I'm kind of overburned. Like it's 2023. I feel like burn down charts in general are kind of really, you know, I would just say they're kind of old, and why would you use them? But I like that you kind of highlight, if you're using burn downs, at least make them messy, because you should be replanning throughout the sprint, right? So I love how you poked at some of those common anti-patterns, but you had a very nuanced conversation around them.
Yeah, that doesn't always come naturally to me. I have to be honest, I'm pretty frank, right? But I really did my best. I mean, there's a chapter on scaling in there. The word safe isn't mentioned once. Mm-hmm. Like, but I did try to be very nuanced, because I felt like I don't want this to be some book where I'm just, how do you say, saying random things, you know? Like I want it to be very nuanced. But yep. Of course, there are also these catchy phrases like humble planning, right? So it's not easy, but I tried.
I think it'll hit with a lot of people because I think people relate to a lot of the things that you talk about in the book. And I think there's going to be teams that fall into that category of, yeah, we actually don't really use sprinkles. And I think this is not that it's just a manual for how to do it, but I think it's going to give them a lot to think about. So I would just nudge people listening. Like if your team, if you fall in that category of like, we're doing Scrum, but we don't really do sprint goals. You should read this book because it's going to give you a great guide to how to get much more value out of Scrum.
So when you're thinking about scaling multiple Scrum teams, you know, working together, like maybe you could just, I really liked your take on it. So maybe you can dive a little bit into that for our listeners. Like what's your recommendation?
Yeah. So the way I see it, right, like when you're working with many teams, it's a complex system, right? It has to work together. So for me, what you see a lot of companies do, they're like, let's use a scaling framework. Doesn't matter which one. Like let's copy paste this bundle mm-hmm. of practices. I really don't think that's the best way of doing things. So I don't know the exact quote that I'm using in the book, but I think it's something from Gall's Law or something. It's about like complex systems have evolved from simple systems, right? Like you start with a simple system that works and then you make it more complicated over time. And those are systems that work. And if you start with a complex system, then it becomes really difficult because it's already complex. You're making it more complex. So what I really believe is we have to instead like think before we scale, like what are our problems and how should we solve those and solve them gradually? Because it's so complex, like it's an organization that like copy pasting a whole bundle of solutions just makes the waters murky, right? Like you have 10 stuff you're doing at the same time. So you probably are introducing new problems and new unpredicted effects because it's a complex system. So yeah, that's kind of in a nutshell what mm-hmm. I try to, probably I did it far better in the book, but what I tried to explain.
Yeah, you know, it's really about trade-offs, right? Like you're going to give and take something when you're talking about many people working together in a common goal, right? It's hard to get alignment. There's a coordination cost to it. And so there's trade-offs. Like, do we spend more time learning? But then we're going to spend less time building and less time discovering. And so you have to make trade-offs in how you align and how you work. Yeah. And I think every organization, needs to like think about that consciously, because when you say, you know, just like a product owner, like every time you say yes to something, you say no to something else. So if you say yes to safe, you know, you're saying no to something else. And are you okay with that? You know, because there definitely are optimizing goals for different frameworks. And then there's ways to tweak them to adjust that as well. Yeah. So I like the way you took the nuanced approach to just scaling. Like there's things to learn from all the frameworks,
yeah,
but you have to take that into consideration in your system.
Yeah, yeah, and do it gradually. Like, don't do 10 things at the same time. Like, because then what works, what doesn't work? Like, I'd be a bit reductionist. Try to remove stuff as well. And we're often scared of doing that. And as well, humble planning, right? Like adding all these big room planning meetings where we're like for 5 days because I have to coordinate with I don't know how many teams. That's not the solution because there's going to be a surprise and all those like wires are going to blow up in your face, like all those dependency wires.
So the other thing that jumps out at me, because I kept highlighting them all throughout the book, at the beginning of each chapter, like a lot of books, you have quotes, right? From various people from the past, maybe from the present. They all resonated with me from, you know, looking at the book, even from, like, I'm a boat rocker. I'm a big change agent. I love challenging the status quo over and over again. And so what I took away from a lot of those quotes was real kind of that change aspect of this, right? And again, I would argue, you know, the content of your book goes way beyond the title of your book, right? Like the phrase, like, don't judge a book by its cover. Like in this scenario, I think you're getting a lot more in the content than the title even alludes to. So I don't know, as again, person who wrote it, do you feel that same level of impact on the change side of things? And do you have any, I guess, thoughts on, you know, those people who struggle to get the buy-in or make the change? Any thoughts on things from the book that they could take away for that?
Yeah, so I think there's a chapter on stakeholder management, like where I talk about stakeholder inclusion or like collaboration. What I think is So this may be, so what I very often I see happening, especially with product owners as well, is like they have to make a roadmap, for example, and because they're scared, they're going to go in their room, like think, make a roadmap, and then present it to the stakeholders. And I think that I also did that because it's very safe, right? You're with your thoughts. You can make everything look perfect. You have the perfect paper victory PowerPoint slide. It feels amazing. You're super comfortable in the meeting. And you should do the opposite. Like I believe you should go with the most important stakeholders in the room and talk about it together, like from the start. Because if you already present a final thing, then you won't have their buy-in. They're already going to go into it like, hey, like, they didn't even talk to me, or like, why didn't we do this? Like, you're just gonna have a lot of friction. So this is one example, like in the book, like where I feel like people should be a bit more like, how do you say, daring, you know, like work together. Like, we're in the same boat. We have different perspectives, right? The salesperson looks at product differently than the product manager, but it doesn't mean that they're evil and doesn't mean that we need to manage them up front. So that's one example, I think.
Yeah, the phrase that Chad and I use instead of stakeholder management is stakeholder engagement. And I think also that's exactly what you're talking about in the book and right here. Yeah, it's just like you're engaging them. You're facilitating the stakeholders collaborating with you, and you're helping to influence the product in a certain direction. And so I think that's a great point. And, you know, so much of it is not, it's not that, I mean this in the nicest way to all the product people. It's not that hard to build a roadmap. Like, the physical elements of building a roadmap is not that hard. Getting everybody aligned in a direction and getting them aligned on that roadmap, that's way harder. And so, like, doing that part together and building the buy-in right away from the start is such a better approach, right? And being more facilitator of that, I think, is really important. So that would be a recommendation I would have, is flip the script. Do the hard part first, like most things in Agile. Like, take the riskiest, most biggest assumption you have and test that first, right? And so the same thing when you're building your product backlog or your roadmap.
And talk to the Scrum Masters, because they usually know about liberating structures and all these things, and they can make your life easier. Like, if you don't know how to do that, they will tell you.
Yep, for sure. Yeah, they can be your partner in crime there to come up with a great way to facilitate that.
You know, so another word that I was a different word, I guess, than I'm used to seeing, was the word friction. And I think you use that all throughout the book. You introduce it early on.
Yeah.
Tell us about the word choice there.
Yeah, so it's actually von Clausewitz that coined, he called it friction, and it's just like something that causes surprises, that makes things go a little bit differently than expected. The more friction, like the more surprises, the more our plans have to change. And I think it's it's a really beautiful concept, because, you know, the Agile Manifesto, right? Like, everybody talks, but I think if you understand friction and you understand the three gaps model, then you can think about Agile without referencing the Agile Manifesto. Because in the end, it's about unpredictability, not being unable to plan. And everything you see in the Agile Manifesto is a way of saying, hey, this is how you should deal with friction. And also, these are the anti-patterns for dealing with friction. So I also allude to that a little bit in the book. But I think that's why friction is such a powerful concept, because instead of talking about the Agile Manifesto, I love the Agile Manifesto, but it comes with all these strings attached. Like, if you drop that word, you don't know how they're going to interpret it. So if you go back and you just explain friction and how it affects, I think it's way safer, as much as the Agile Manifesto is beautiful.
So I got a question for you. So we've spent a lot of time in the book. You just finished writing this great book. Everybody should read it. But, like, what are you really excited about right now? Like, what's the next thing that you're really excited about?
Yeah. So
in the Agile space.
So I'm really excited about dysfunction mapping from Michael Lloyd. Are you familiar with it? Probably you might know. So it's very.
No.
It's something, when you hear it, it's kind of obvious, right? But that's what makes it so brilliant, because a lot of people are already doing this, but not as consciously. So this is dysfunction mapping in a way. So imagine you join a team, right? And then you're observing, you see all these problems. Dysfunction mapping offers a way to map all those problems. So it starts with, write down all the symptoms that you're experiencing, right? So all the things that are not going as smoothly. Then you write like the dysfunctions, like the stuff that's missing or not, like, for example, they're not using a definition of done. These of course, are all have their assumptions in them, and they're from the perspective of Scrum. And then you have purpose. So you think about, okay, so what is the purpose of a definition of done? Instead of saying we have to get a definition of done, right? There's a step, purpose, like what happened. And then you can think about solutions. And the beauty is you get this systematic tree of all the problems and symptoms of a team together with like potential solutions. And then you can show that to the team and say, hey, like we have this problem. The cycle time is too high, but code review is also too high. And then you can think about it in a systematic way. And you're already doing this in your head, but it just is a very beautiful template to help with that. So I'm really excited about that. Did I explain it kind of? Yeah.
I think it sounds great. It sounds, it's not exactly related, but we're big fans of systems modeling, and we've attended the large scale Scrum class with Craig Larman multiple times. And most of the 3 days you spend doing causal loop diagrams on the wall. Yeah. And the phrase that always comes up is like, you can't take this and just show it to somebody, but the magic happens when a group of a team or humans, you get together and you model together on the wall, and you bring your thoughts from your brain, right? Yeah. Out onto the wall for conversation. It sounds very similar. You're making it very visible. Everyone's involved in the creation of that. And then you can use it going forward and make the change happen. So it sounds, it does sound obvious, like things you would do, but maybe gives a little bit more, tangible piece to it to give people kickstarted on it.
It sounds less scary than causal loop diagrams. Sorry.
Yeah. For sure. Yeah.
You know how like a mind can only maybe hold on to a few ideas at one time, you know, like in a conversation. Correct. Or whatever? It sounds like this like kind of visualizes it for you and then like lets you look at different options for how you could solve your problems and seeing the loops, right? So has that been your experience? Like it helps you to like see the big picture and then see different options for the solutions?
So I have to be fair, right? I've studied it. I really like it. I'm thinking of implementing it somewhere, but I haven't used it yet. Like, so this is just I just finished my book. This is just something I saw. I was like, oh, I have to use it somewhere. It seemed, I cannot speak from experience yet. I just have to be frank.
Okay.
All right. Can I read one of my favorite, it's one of the quotes that you use from another person in one. It's towards the end. So I don't want to like spoil it, but if you're okay with it, I think it's worth it.
Yeah, you can. Yeah, I'm totally cool with it. I also have a favorite quote. So, and you can tell me yours.
Oh, okay. Well, you should do yours after mine, but if they're the same one, then
we're just soulmates.
So towards the end of the book, again, this is the change piece that just gets me so excited, but you have a quote by writer William Arthur Ward, and it says, "The pessimist complains about the wind, the optimist expects it to change, and the realist adjusts the sails." Right? Like, I just think that says so much to the way we think about change. Right? It's if you let change happen to you, it will happen to you all day long. But if you make those small little adjustments and you keep looking forward and taking that step, right, and trying something, I just think good things will happen, right? Career-wise, Scrum-wise, Agile-wise, whatever it is. So anyway, that quote, I love that quote towards the end, but I have so many other favorites. What was your favorite?
Yeah, so we're not soulmates, but it was the Spielberg quote in the book. So Steven Spielberg, I really liked, like, so as a young kid, I was, I'm going to paraphrase, I don't know it by memory, it's something along the lines of, as a young kid, I was carrying a camera and bossing people around. And then as an adult, I made movies with professionals we couldn't have made all on our own, just as a group of people, something along those lines. So I thought it was a very beautiful quote because, that's kind of like what I feel a lot of people go through. You know, when you're young, you want to prove yourself, you want to show that you're smart. And then at some point you're like, I don't really, and I'm not that important. Like, it's about the team. How can we achieve the best? And I really like that quote, that humility in the quotes he had.
That's great. Love it.
All right. Is there anything else, Martin, that you would like to like promote or plug to our listeners as we kind of wrap up this podcast?
No, I mean, not really, to be honest. Like, my book is everything at the moment. That's it. So
So what? How could people help you out with the book? What would be the things that really help a new author out?
What would really help? So people already doing these things. So I'm super grateful. Like people. So there are a lot of people that ask me like, hey, Maarten, where should I buy the book that so that you get the most money out of it? And I always write back to them. The book is a loss leader. Like I spent 3 years on it. I'm gonna lose money on it, and I'm cool with that. Like, so. Because what the engagements, you know, like that follow, that's where the money is made ultimately, hopefully, you know. So what they can do is share it on LinkedIn. Like when you receive the book, write a review, like on Amazon, write a review on Goodreads, on Google Books. That helps a lot. And I would be super grateful. But of course, you know, people are free to do whatever they want, but that would help me a lot.
For sure. Yeah. The reviews are, I know, I guess just other authors we've, you know, talked to and stuff, like those early reviews really do matter. So if anybody does, you know, pick this book up after this podcast and reads it, like just know like that those early reviews are really important. So I'm sure Maarten would just really appreciate it if you left a review.
If you found value in today's episode, share this with a friend. Until next time, get agile and stay agile.